This is where electricity comes in. Turing's imagined computer couldn't simply have a lot of wires locked into one particular configuration. The switches would have to be so small and work so fast that miniature metal cogs and gears, the stuff of conventional adding machines, wouldn't suffice. Telephone companies had reached the limits of simple metal switches a long time before. Their first improved switches consisted of sturdy young men who physically took out plugs from one line that ran up through a hole in a large board and pushed them into another line. Since that board was where all the switching took place, the term switchboard was soon born. When supervisors found that the men swore too much, and also that they were easily roused to join unions, the males were replaced by more genteel females. When Bell System administrators in the late 1890s found that even great offices filled with such women were overburdened, the first semi-electrical switches came into use. Unfortunately, even the most advanced telephone switches of the 1930s were far too big for Turing's purposes. What he needed, of course, were the new insights in physics about teleporting electrons and the rest of what was termed quantum mechanics. The new theory suggested the electrons could do the switching without having to be guided along slowly swiveling wires. Instead, if the right quantum rules could ever be applied, electrons could be made to jump and switch position even within solid, unmoving matter. That was the dream, and Turing had studied enough physics to know of the new research in quantum mechanics. Many of the founders of that field were working around him in Cambridge. But like other engineers and mathematicians, he believed that quantum effects were perpetually hidden away from us, limited to a submicroscopic realm too small ever to be of use. It seems at this time he never seriously considered that quantum switches could be his answer. Because of the professional fame from his Hilbert papers, Turing was invited to spend some time at Princeton, where the equally brilliant professor John von Neumann taught. At first, von Neumann seemed to be the intellectual companion Turing sought, but von Neumann had always been a great chameleon. In Hungary, where he'd been raised, his first name had been Hanos. Then, in Göttingen, he'd happily become Johann, and now in Princeton, he was good old Johnny. He'd become hyper-Americanized and insisted on a social life that was dominated by loud cocktail parties. Turing seems to have gone to a few of these parties, but he could never reach von Neumann emotionally, and returned to England after only a few semesters. During World War II, Turing was hired as part of the British government's code-breaking group at Bletchley Park in the south of England. There were academics there exulting at being freed from the stuffiness of old Oxbridge College, and there were crossword experts and naval officers and a director of research for the John Lewis department stores, who was also a chess champion. And in this mix, Turing came alive. He'd always liked using his wits for practical goals. At Cambridge, he'd casually taught himself to tell the time by looking at the stars, and at Bletchley, around the impromptu cricket pitches and the red brick huts on the manor house's grounds, he got his chance. He was assigned to the team working on cracking the Enigma machines, which much of the German Army and Navy used to encode their messages. Within a few weeks, Turing had helped devise new techniques for code breaking, and within 2 months, he was head of the unit breaking all German naval codes. In late 1940, this was one of the most vital of all British operations, for if more of the U-boats that were destroying Atlantic convoys could not be found, Britain would slowly but inevitably starve. His unit needed to build some sort of device that could at least partly duplicate the inner workings of the German machines and churn through tens of thousands of permutations each hour. The British device, running with cogs and punch tape and simple circuitry, was given the label Bombi. It wasn't a computer, for lots of clerks were needed to run the Bombi devices, first dozens of them, then hundreds. Almost all were young women, recruited usually from proper upper-middle-class families into the Women's Royal Naval Service, WRENS for short. But there was something curious about this combination of humans plus machines. For with the WRENS and the Bombi device working together, Turing had created the closest thing yet to the universal computer he had imagined in the quiet pre-war years. That combination of WRENS plus the simple electric circuits in the machines they supervised was, in a sense, the hardware. When fresh data came in from the outside world, when the Germans switched to a different encoding procedure or a colleague proposed a new approach, Turing simply had to reprogram the whole group working for him. Progress was slow at first. Sometimes convoys sailed toward areas where the Navy knew there were packs of U-boats waiting, but the clacking Wren-directed machinery couldn't break the intercepted German shortwave signals in time. They would realize with dread that ships were exploding, sailors drowning. But Turing was a master at organizing small groups, and increasingly often they succeeded. His computer didn't yet exist as one centralized physical object, but he now had the equivalent of most of its parts. The memory, the processor, the reconfigurable software, working away, albeit scattered in separate buildings, and made of such disparate elements as female Wrens, copper electrical wires, and Turing's own thoughts. And then he fell in love, or at least very much in like. Joan Clark was a young Cambridge mathematics student who'd been sent to his division at Bletchley. He told her that he had homosexual tendencies, but she didn't seem to mind, and they began the sort of romance that any overworked, mathematically fascinated young couple would find normal. Turing's work had been important enough that he was awarded the coveted Order of the British Empire. A memo he wrote to Downing Street about delays in supplies to Bletchley had even resulted in Churchill jolting his principal staff officer with a memo, "Action this day. Make sure they have all they want on extreme priority." But even so, the newer, larger version of the Bombay, named Colossus, still needed to be laboriously reconfigured almost every day, as the Germans regularly changed the details of how messages were sent. The machine was more than a calculator, but not yet a true programmable computer. It could make only the simplest of sorting decisions on its own. Compared to what Turing had imagined, it was still excruciatingly slow.